just launching now something called Start.coop, a first equity accelerator for cooperative startups in the United States, trying to bridge those gaps, trying to create interfaces between the legacy cooperative ecosystem and the new startups, enabling older, bigger cooperatives to actually invest and benefit from the success of new startups. So this is a really exciting moment, an opportunity to shift the basis of this economy.
That's Nathan Schneider, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Nathan Schneider on co-ops, economic democracy. One day, a few years ago, I was walking in San Francisco's Mission District and looked up and saw a sign that said, Arizmendi Bakery, worker-owned and operated. This piqued my curiosity. I went inside to find out more. I learned that Arizmendi was the name of the priest who in the 1950s helped launch the Mondragon Cooperative in the hardscrabble Basque region of Spain. Today, Mondragon is one of the most successful co-ops in the world. It employs more than 70,000 workers and is the 10th largest enterprise in Spain. In the Bay Area, inspired by the Mondragon example, workers have formed multiple co-ops. Co-ops have a long tradition. They're characterized by democratic decision-making, equitable pay, and worker input. In response to robber-baron contemporary capitalism, workers from taxi drivers to dairy farmers are forming co-ops. To talk about co-ops is Nathan Schneider. He's a journalist and professor of media studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's written for Harper's, The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Times, and The Catholic Worker. He's the author of Everything for Everybody, The Radical Tradition That is Shaping the Next Economy. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado. And now, Nathan Schneider.
I'm going to begin with a kind of review of the last decade. The work that I'm speaking from is very much of that period. It is built out of a crisis and a certain understanding of that crisis and a sequence of reactions to it. I'm of the generation that was profoundly foreclosed upon a decade ago. In the 2007-2008 financial crisis that became a world economic crisis that began out of the behavior of the economic system in this country, particularly the financial system. In the time since, the way in which the generation of young people who came of age in that moment are the first in American history to be on track to do worse than the previous generation. You see also a decline of faith in democracy. I think these are connected. A decline of faith in democracy, not simply because we weren't taught that democracy is good, we weren't taught what's in the Constitution, for instance, but actually that the system as it is not working for us in fundamental ways. This is a kind of global trend, and we see it in the turn among people around the world to more authoritarian regimes and political systems, growing out of a very genuine failure. This isn't just a takeover by certain kinds of political forces. We come by this current authoritarian turn honestly. Now, I spent the first decade of this, or the first half of this decade, covering resistance. I was involved in founding the website Waging Nonviolence, covering resistance movements around the world. I was very, very deeply involved in Occupy Wall Street, covering the early planning meetings that led to it in New York City, and then sticking around after all the other reporters left, and followed what these people got up to next. That was a moment that where this generation, I think, had to figure out what it actually stood for. This is the generation, you know, too, whose first kind of political moment was the election of Barack Obama, who then carried out the Bush administration's bailout plan, essentially. And so this generation that had elected him, that had been so a part of the excitement surrounding that election, had to step back and say, what is it that we really stand for? And this turned out to be not so much, you know, carrying out particular policy demands, even though that was actually the initial proposal for that protest, but has been about creating spaces of democracy. I think really trying to reinvent democracy, first through resistance, and then through other stuff. For instance, the first business that I remember coming out of Occupy Wall Street was a print shop. It's now called Radix Media. It's part of a, you know, bigger worker cooperative, but it was owned by the people who were working there. It was a print shop to support the movement. It was a political organizing tool, but also a way of having a livelihood in the midst of an economy that these people had not yet managed to transform. And this was only one of many examples. People, for instance, after Hurricane Sandy in New York City in 2012, got involved in starting cooperatives in the Rockaways, in areas that had been most severely affected by the storm, turning to this tradition of democratic enterprise in the wake of a movement that was so much committed to practicing democracy. They were drawing on a long tradition here, a tradition of cooperative enterprise that goes back kind of in the Anglophone world to about the 1840s, though it has, you know, really been, its features have been present in economies as long as history can remember. But this is also a tradition that grew up in a particularly modern form alongside the development of industrial capitalism. Sometimes we hear this talked about as the new economy or an alternative economy. But I think it's important to recognize the way in which this has been part of shaping the modern world in really significant and important ways. Ways that I didn't realize even when I was watching these protesters start to get involved in small startup cooperative businesses. You know, I'd been involved in cooperatives before. You know, when I was a kid, my mother would take me to some, I remember it as a kind of closet where we could get soy milk. And in college, I was part of a housing co-op, you know, where I learned to cook. We had two-hour meetings every Sunday night that were absolutely excruciating. But nevertheless, I absolutely loved it. This tradition is much bigger than that. For instance, since moving to Colorado, I've done some more exploring into my family history. My grandfather, he was born in Johnstown, a little bit north of here, on a farm that had no electricity until the rural electric cooperatives financed through the 1936 Rural Electrification Act came in this case the Poudre Valley Rural Electric Association. And later in his life, he got involved in the hardware business. And later in life, he ran a company, actually, helped grow it to a national scale. It was one of the largest hardware distributors at the time. And, you know, it was always, you know, I always remember hearing about this. I remember he died when I was young, but I remember the belt buckle that he would wear on his belt after he was retired that said Trustworthy, which was the brand that his company, Liberty Distributors, would use. And it wasn't until much more recently, as I was in the midst of following and documenting this new generation in the cooperative movement, that I started digging around in his own story and realized that that company he had been running was a cooperative. Now, this was kind of shocking to me because it's hard to imagine anyone more different from these Occupy activists that I had been with than my grandfather. You know, this was a farm boy with a fourth to sixth grade education, who was, especially later in life, very conservative, voted for all the opposite people, you know, that you can imagine, held a lot of convictions that ran counter, perhaps, to those of the occupiers. But nevertheless, you know, when I have a tape of him talking about this business, you know, I have some, you know, recollections from people who worked with him, and the reasons were actually not so different. He was interested in supporting small town business, and you know, the way to do that was to form a cooperative that those, you know, smaller businesses would own and that would be accountable to them, that would provide them with economies of scale. This is also a kind of business that has powered our social movements in ways that I didn't understand when I first got involved in this. You know, we tend to think of social movements as being these kind of moments of resistance, you know, the flashpoints of conflict, and those are important. But, you know, for instance, when Gandhi talked about his method of satyagraha, of nonviolent civil resistance, he always talked about the positive program, as he called it, as being 90% of the work. You know, the conflict was just a tiny little kind of tip of the iceberg. The bulk of the work, as he understood it, was building, you know, small-scale community, building alternative economies. There's that word again. Building real, resilient economies. That spinning wheel on the Indian flag, right, is a reflection of this, as part of the economic resistance that he was involved in building against the British. And I've seen the same thing in, for instance, the U.S. South. When I was, for instance, reporting on Cooperation Jackson, an effort to build a cooperative economy in Jackson, Mississippi, now has elected its second mayor, who is deeply committed to this work. I was asking around among the civil rights elders who were there. You know, I was asking a mentor of mine who'd been part of SNCC in the 1960s, had been in Jackson as well. Asked them, were you ever involved in setting up cooperatives, anything like that? And everybody says, of course, we were doing that the whole way. Who do you think was registering to vote but the cooperative members, you know, who couldn't be kicked off their land by a landlord? Right, who own their land cooperatively with other black farmers, using organizations like the Federation for Southern Cooperatives and others. This is a part of our resistance history. Martin Luther King Jr. was trying to set up credit unions, often being suppressed by regulators in the process, wherever he was organizing. He saw that democratic finance would be a valuable tool for enabling people to sustain resistance. Today, a system that, when pressed, when handed a crisis, chooses to protect the wealth of the very wealthy rather than the fledgling prospects of the vulnerable, this is a crisis of accountability. To whom are they accountable? Where do they turn when there's a hard decision to make? When those executives are lying in bed at night knowing that they have to make a hard decision in the morning, you know, who are they thinking of? I don't think we've come to terms with the causes of the 2008 crash. I don't think that's a controversial thing to say either. There has been some additional regulation and then some rollback of that regulation. But even those steps, I think all of us can recognize, aren't enough. That the fundamental ingredients of this crisis and every crisis that has preceded it require a kind of fundamental rethinking of the economy. And this is a rethinking that I think we have tools for that we don't realize are in our midst. I wonder if this tradition can help. And first, I think it's really important to recognize how it might work. So this is a tradition, this tradition of cooperative enterprise that is hidden in plain sight in our midst. This is a kind of business that is at work all around us, and I think has helped to make some of the better parts of the world as it is. So I think of this not necessarily as a strict, radical, in every sense, alternative to the status quo. This is actually part of some of the best things of the world as we know it, and things that actually capitalism then takes credit for. Capitalism in that sense of control by profit-seeking impulses alone, competition, again through profit-seeking at all costs. It is a kind of business that points down toward local communities, enabling them to have economies of scale, structurally different than the kind of conglomeration we see. Compare, for instance, the way that Home Depot organizes itself and grows compared to the way that Ace Hardware enables a company like McGuckin to make its own choices about how it's going to operate in a local community. So, how did all this happen? Because of that farmer organizing in particular, as well as the development of the credit union movement, by World War II, cooperative enterprise was really a very mainstream part of the American economic scene. This is something that had become a signature piece of, for instance, New Deal legislation, where in addition to the electric cooperatives, New Deal programs were setting up cooperative housing communities, cooperative purchasing, even cooperative newspapers in those local communities. This was a model that had become a feature of U.S. policy, and you can find these amazing films from that period produced by the government articulating this vision of cooperatives and this idea of the cooperative commonwealth as the next phase of democracy. This, again, is built on the basis of longstanding organizing and resistance. Farmers against urban elites, the railroads, the oil companies, those that were controlling their access to markets, as well as the labor movement. In the period especially before the current labor relations regime established around 1938, the labor unions, which did not have the kinds of legal protections that they would later obtain, or the structures of interaction with their opponents, often used cooperatives as a means of strengthening their hand, of organizing workers, not just as a means of strengthening their resistance, but actually of furthering and advancing a vision in which workers would become eventually the owners. You know, this became lost. This was a major feature of that 1938 agreement, you know, that labor would kind of consign itself to perpetual conflict rather than aiming to claim power, ultimate power in industry. You know, unions like the International Workers of the World, where you can still find a plaque memorializing workers killed in, you know, nearby coal mines here, had that kind of vision, and cooperatives were part of how they and others, like the Knights of Labor, would organize to win. Also, this tradition is incredibly important among African Americans. For instance, in 1907, W.E.B. Du Bois, the most prominent black intellectual of the time, put a great deal of energy into documenting and organizing cooperatives among black Americans across the country. For instance, in this report from 1907, He listed several cooperatives in Colorado, including a worker-owned saddle shop in Denver. This was an essential tool for survival among black Americans under constant conflict. This movement also built a powerful financial infrastructure that enabled cooperatives to, in many areas of American agriculture, become dominant forces, enabling small players to have some say in their access to markets, their access to inputs. So we see brands now today that are kind of ho-hum, like Ocean Spray, like Land O'Lakes, like Sunkist. These are all cooperative brands. And then in later generations, that infrastructure enabled the development of, for instance, Organic Valley, enabled for farmers to access the growing organic foods movement, which was also being developed on the consumer side, organized demand through consumer cooperatives like the one my mother took me to when I was a kid, right? Before the big grocery stores recognized that there was value in that demand, that there was opportunity, people had to organize it for themselves. So this store is built in many respects off of that cooperative tradition. These farmers also were able to advocate at a national level, again, to pass the 1936 Rural Electrification Act, which brought electricity to the 90% of the American countryside that was not getting electricity by the mid-30s, and as well as a financial system that we see in examples like CoBank, the $128 billion cooperative bank that sits just on the south end of Denver. In the financial industry beyond this, we might even consider Visa. Visa is a company that that was spun off of Bank of America, at a time when the credit card industry was still in development, and Bank of America realized they couldn't really manage this mess of dealing with all of these client banks all across the country. So a fellow from a Seattle regional bank named Dee Hawk proposed, hey, why don't you spin it off, license the business to us, we'll run it as a cooperative owned by those banks. Now, this worked. This was the model that enabled the credit card business to get going. And one thing that's interesting, too, is to look at, for instance, the vision that Dee Hawk had for what the credit card business might become, in contrast to what it has become under subsequent demutualization and conversion to investor ownership, where it's become, in many cases, very predatory industry. That was not the vision pursued by those who were leading this cooperative model. I wrote to Dee Hawk about what has happened since, and he explains that he regarded this turn as economically greedy, socially unjust, creatively barren, philosophically foolish, and a disappointment to its founder. Another piece of this is the credit union movement. In North America, this movement came through a particular lineage. It was also developing in other ways across the pond. The Germans, in particular, had a very strong credit union movement. But in the Americas, it began among farmers in the maritime provinces of Canada, was drawn into the economic mainstream in Quebec, especially by Alphonse Desjardins, a journalist turned entrepreneur who built what is now the largest financial institution in Quebec. He was brought down to the United States by Edward Filene, the department store magnate, who became fascinated with model. This model wanted to set it up among his employees and also created a lot of the enabling legislation in the United States for credit unions. He also gave us the kind of ambivalent gift of the language of the credit union itself, which has been, I think, very accessible for many people, but also falsely differentiates this model from cooperatives. These are simply consumer cooperatives for finance and banking. Another great figure, that one of the many, many incredible entrepreneurs that should be up there or above the likes of Steve Jobs and so forth in this cooperative tradition are people like Father Albert McKnight, a Catholic priest and Pan-Africanist who helped develop the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. And then we see examples, outcomes like CoBank, as I mentioned before, tremendous institutions built on the basis of this kind of organizing. Nevertheless, we forget what we're capable of, and that memory can be taken from us, and it has been. After World War II, with the advent of the Cold War, there is a demonstrable impact that ideological climate had on this tradition. We can see it, for instance, in economics and business textbooks, where this tradition, which was once part of that economic mainstream in at least some significant ways, was almost completely dropped, regarded as a kind of footnote. And that remains the case today. We do know education, for instance, at the University of Colorado Business School on cooperative enterprise. And when I called up the 20 leading business schools in the country for an article for the Chronicle of Higher Education, they said the same if they even knew what I was talking about. This was part of a process of a Red Scare. You know, my grandfather, that good old, farm boy capitalist, didn't really talk about his business as a cooperative. I had to find it in the bylaws. Because he had been so trained to present what he was doing as that good old American capitalism, right? And many businesses using the cooperative or mutual or employee ownership models did the same. They stopped talking about what they were doing. They stopped identifying with it. They practiced it, but they didn't want to draw attention to what they were doing for fear of difficulty. Meanwhile, the 60s counterculture adopted the cooperative movement in new ways, especially around food and acquiring consumer products that weren't as accessible, that were connected with counterculture values. But they tended to keep these businesses small and kind of pure. You know, often when posed with the choice of whether to expand to lower cost goods, to make compromises on their commitments that would enable them to gain greater reach, they decided not to. And so you see, you know, this contrast, for instance, where the United States grocery cooperative footprint is relatively low. That economy that they created in organic and natural and local food has been largely ceded to the likes of Whole Foods and now Amazon. Compare that to Italy, where the Catholic Church and Communist Party were actively developing cooperatives through this period. Now the two largest grocery chains in Italy are cooperatives, the largest being a consumer cooperative chain, where you can see stores that range from something that looks like a Whole Foods to something that looks like a Target. You know, they opted to manage their own compromise rather than staying pure and allowing the capitalists to profit from the compromises necessary to meet people's needs in the society. Now, the new generation of cooperators is really starting from scratch in a lot of respects. There has been this great legacy and tradition, but you don't see it when you talk to people who are starting these things today. You know, they don't have a lot of mentors supporting them from older generations who've done this stuff. They don't have a lot of financial opportunities because a lot of the financial infrastructure that's been built, organizations like CoBank are very focused on particular sectors that aren't as relevant to a lot of these new cooperators. So it means, on the one hand, there's this legacy, but on the other hand, there's a kind of vacuum. And meanwhile, the language of the sharing economy among digital platforms, platforms like Uber and Lyft and Airbnb and others, have excited people's imaginations about the possibility of sharing. But these are companies that themselves are owned largely by early stage venture capitalists and founders, and who are accountable very directly to the profit-seeking motives of those owners. So there's been also a kind of disenchantment among those initially drawn to this idea of the sharing economy when the recognition sets in that this is a kind of corporate rental economy, even though there's a lot of really exciting opportunities available through these kinds of platforms. How could they be organized differently? How could that sharing economy genuinely share? So I've been involved in the development of a movement called platform cooperativism, trying to bring this cooperative model into the online economy. Examples include Up and Go, which is a home cleaning platform where you can schedule home cleanings on an app in New York City and get services from employee-owned worker cooperatives, largely run and owned by immigrant women. This has been rapidly developing. We've got platforms and projects building around the world. We have just been working with a large grant to develop a co-op development kit, which is developing open source software to enable these kinds of businesses to happen more easily. We're just launching now something called Start.coop, a first equity accelerator for cooperative startups in the United States, trying to bridge those gaps, trying to create interfaces between the legacy cooperative ecosystem and the new startups, enabling older, bigger cooperatives to actually invest and benefit from the success of new startups. People are playing with cryptocurrency, with more diverse founders than the typical Silicon Valley startup that you might imagine. There's a growing appetite for new kinds of financing and strategy in the tech economy, coming from a lot of corners. So this is a really exciting moment, an opportunity to shift the basis of this economy.
You're listening to Nathan Schneider on Co-ops, Economic Democracy. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
You know, when I'm consulting with these startups, you know, which are running into so many brick walls, you know, which are running into so many challenges, which have so little infrastructure to help them get started compared to anybody who wants to sell a business meant to be powered and bought by the highest bidder and the most powerful investor, I find myself turning to the past all the time. I find myself more and more just like trying to draw on resources of how people have done this before as like the only assurance I have left that this can really be possible. But I think it is. You know, and this is the question I ask myself all the time. How can we make it easier to do business with democracy? How can we actually push democracy further into more spaces of our lives, rather than simply defending, you know, through ACLU suits and things like that, the structures of 200-year-old and more political systems that haven't really been serving us anyway. Now, one kind of odd thing that I've started to notice more and more, it's hard to notice because there's different languages being spoken, different kinds of rhetoric. But actually, you know, for instance, if you look down the Congressional Cooperative Business Caucus, you start to see, you know, Democrats and Republicans in pretty much equal number. People who agree about this stuff, who agree about almost nothing else, actually agree about this stuff. If you look at the 2016 platforms of the Democratic and Republican Party, for instance, they both encourage the development of more employee ownership of businesses. They have different reasons for doing it. You know, as you might imagine, Democrats are very interested in, you know, economic inequality and so forth, and Republicans are very interested in expanding capital ownership, and, you know, the language is different. But actually, the objective is much the same. And this was reflected, unfortunately, part of the Defense Appropriations Bill, but there was a Main Street Employee Ownership Act passed by bipartisan leadership, especially supported by Kirsten Gillibrand's office as the senator from New York, that is the first piece of legislation in a good number of years now, advancing and expanding the opportunities for financing employee ownership, especially for you know, what's called the silver tsunami, the millions of businesses in the country that are facing uncertain futures without a succession plan as baby boomers retire. How many of those might be good candidates for employee ownership rather than the kind of private equity buyouts that are currently the norm? At the same time, local jurisdictions around the country are experimenting with policies to support the development of various kinds of cooperative businesses. This is especially happening in urban centers focused on expanding employee ownership. So we see New York City investing millions in supporting technical assistance. We see Newark, New Jersey, doing a revolving loan fund, actually financing conversions. We see efforts in Madison, Wisconsin, Austin, Texas. Philadelphia has just stepped in. The list of these cities is growing. Richmond, California. And each of these is trying something different. And we're learning from the results of those experiments, hopefully to enable us to have a much more evidence-based national agenda. And already we see a lot of the leading lights of the Democratic Party looking to retake government that are interested in these kinds of opportunities. And hopefully that opportunity, you know, won't be squashed by a kind of pure partisanship. Because the weird thing about this is an issue that right now people on both sides of the American party system weirdly actually agree about. I wonder whether this strange consensus built on, again, the legacies of rural cooperative organization and the cooperatives that are still the bedrock of so much of the rural red state economy, and the progressive impulses of the blue urban centers that are interested in expanding employee ownership. Can these be brought together? Can this be a new kind of political force that can bring a new kind of hope through not just another demagogue, but a kind of fresh faith in democracy? A new generation really is organizing around these kinds of strategies, doing it around climate issues, around racial justice issues, connecting the issues that matter to them to cooperative economies. And one of the organizations that's done a really great job of harnessing that power is the New Economy Coalition. And if you're interested in this topic, I really encourage you to look at them. This is an organization that's worked very hard to focus on the prospects of cooperative business and economy, while also connecting it really thoroughly with the diversity that they need, with the inclusivity and intersectionality, as they say, that these movements really need to be relevant to people's lives today. Another opportunity, I think, is around reclaiming the cooperative economy that's already in our midst. And organizations like We Own It are starting to do this, using tools developed for political mobilization, you know, for electoral campaigns, and actually applying them to cooperative campaigns, enabling, for instance, this is a project through the NAACP, enabling rural folks in Mississippi and Alabama to organize to take power in their electric cooperatives, which are often white-run, even in black-majority areas. And when this happens, we often also see cooperatives embrace more renewable energy, embrace investments in broadband internet. You know, here in Boulder, super tech hub, we get slower, more expensive internet than the farmers who are members of the Delta Montrose Rural Electric Association out on the Western Slope, because they have a cooperative that decided to invest in high-speed broadband, and they're getting incredible opportunities through that, and it's helping to power a kind of new rural tech boom in that area. So this is really an interesting opportunity for us, but it's also an opportunity that's being pursued in local areas around the country. So we're part of that broader experimentation that I hope will develop a new generation of policies and strategies and culture for the next cooperative commonwealth. Now, once again, it's been a decade since that crisis began, and its causes are still with us. I hope that the stories that I've been working to document, I and others, and to help write, to build, will help us get a head start on the crises to come. Thank you so much for your attention. In regard to the medieval legacy of commons and sharing, to me, there's quite a bit there. Actually, one of the chapters in my book focuses on that. It actually focuses on efforts among young people today to recuperate those traditions. So, for instance, there's one journey into a group called the Unmonastery in Italy, in southern Italy, where a bunch of hackers from across Europe got together with all their computers and whatever, and started practicing the rule of Saint Benedict, the kind of main rule for the medieval monastics, and saw this as a generative tool for working through the current crisis, recognizing that monasticism was developed as a response to, you know, the crisis of the collapse of the Roman Empire. Another example, for instance, is in the guilds. I looked at a co-working space in New York City developed by entrepreneurs there who used the model of medieval guilds as the basis of their organizing in the high-tech economy. And then, too, I think there's so much to be drawn from, especially among the figures who were caught in the process of enclosure. That literature of the enclosure crisis across Europe, where commonly held land was shifted to private ownership by often distant capitalists, right? It's an incredible literature because it testifies to what was lost and to what was changing. You know, someone I turn to a lot is Silvia Federici, an autonomist, Italian philosopher and historian who writes about this enclosure process a great deal, and especially from a feminist perspective, looks at what in terms of women's wisdom and economies was destroyed and lost in that process. I think we're in a moment of really interesting opportunity for the labor movement in the United States. We're also in a moment of total crisis, right, where the model established in the late 1930s is not working anymore. It has been so thoroughly, its vulnerabilities have been so thoroughly exploited by its enemies, right? And I think this is a moment where there's a real opportunity to look to the inspiration of examples like the IWW, the Knights of Labor, other pre-1930s labor formations, which used this coordinated cooperation and resistance together. And we're already seeing that. For instance, Green Taxi Cooperative in Denver, you know, large taxi cooperative formed kind of in the wake of Uber, was formed with the Communication Workers of America, their offices in the CWA basement. And that's one of a growing number of union co-ops that are forming around the country. There's a center actually even in Ohio working to organize these, better connect the labor unions with cooperative models, recognizing that, hey, if it becomes harder and harder for unions to organize workplaces for a variety of reasons, what would it look like for unions to invest more of their resources in helping to create workplaces of their own? Our workers are only going to get a good deal. They're going to have better lives if they are able to live affordably relatively near to where they work, right? And so I think it's important for us to ally with those forces that want to see that kind of world, you know, right, in which there's a kind of integral relationship between work and life, and there's not a whole lot of obnoxious transportation in between. Cooperatives have often been very good at taking on moments where the demand or where something like the supply doesn't meet the demand, where there's a chokehold on a feature of the economy and people want better options, right? And one example of this is in renewable energy. So, for instance, across Europe, a lot of the rapid transition, to the extent that it's happened, has been enabled by people forming cooperatives to buy their own resources for solar and wind. And in principle, this seems like a tremendous opportunity because it enables people to act on their own values and impulses rather than simply waiting for the, you know, the profit-seeking investor ownership model to come around to recognizing the economic opportunity and what they're doing. Cooperatives allow us to be fuller selves in the economy than we might otherwise be. And cooperative business models can be points of leverage, but it varies from place to place. For instance, our electric cooperatives in the United States are in a kind of unfortunate position right now where back in the 70s, at a time where the major concern was around energy independence, the U.S. government compelled a lot of those cooperatives into investing very heavily in long-term coal projects. And so now a lot of these cooperatives, which could in principle choose to move renewable much more quickly than they have been kind of stuck and are trying to get out of that. Now, that shift is happening now much more quickly in the electric cooperative sector, and they're starting to build tremendous momentum. But it's been slower than it might otherwise be because of some external and historical constraints. But cooperatives without those constraints, like with a whole another set of constraints, like in Kauai and Hawaii, they are going renewable faster than anybody, and the rest of the country is starting to follow suit. You know, we're in a world that still thinks of itself as kind of dependent on and powered by the pursuit of private profit. I think we're better than that. You know, I think we're capable of better things than that. But often the alternative that has been presented has been a version of the public, in which public means national, territorial, geographical government. Maybe it's a state run kind of communist type endeavor, or maybe it's just, you know, more public goods, more state-run services, state healthcare, blah, blah, blah. I think in a lot of the cases that are starting to come across my desk, that model is not any more appealing, For instance, when we're talking about transnational online platforms, where Facebook is having problems in Myanmar as well as in the US elections, we need to have a different conception of public. And we don't have institutions that can or should play that kind of public role. And that's where I think the opportunity of the cooperative model is really exciting, in challenging the kind of narrow nationalisms that people in many cases are kind of reverting to and defaulting to in the midst of the failure of private markets. Instead, build democracy more into our economic structures. Again, allow ourselves to be fuller people inside our economic lives. One case that just kind of astonishes me is, like, you know, this is something we've seen a few times, where the shareholders of ExxonMobil, like, sue the company when they learn that the company has known about climate change for decades and has been suppressing that information. They sue the company for lost profits. And they have to. You can't sue the company as a shareholder for being mean to the planet Earth, right? You have to, your shareholder role is so narrowly defined by that structure that you can't be a full person and say, stop destroying the world for my grandchildren. You know, that's not an option. And that's why I think it's really important to build on these models that allow us to be fuller people and make our own compromises in our businesses and say, look, we're going to allow ourselves to choose people over profit. We're going to allow ourselves to have a conception of the common good in the way we do business and to make hard choices because of that. Now, cooperatives are one way of doing this. It's an old way of doing it. I like it because it's old and because it works and it's working all around us. Another example, for instance, is the B Corp movement, you know, where people are writing into their corporate statutes provisions that allow them to make those hard choices on behalf of the common good, even if it costs short-term profit. You know, this is a moment where there's a lot of creativity and opportunity for imagining how to solve this problem, you know, this fixation, this kind of like pathetic idea of ourselves that we've built into the structures of the economy, that all we want is, you know, is short-term economic profits, right? When in fact, of course, we want so much more. You know, the challenge is too, if you introduce more stuff and more complex dimensional needs, you know, that can create other kinds of problems, which is again why I think it's useful to build on, you know, on legacies that have to some degree proven themselves. Around housing, this is a complex story that takes many forces, and this is something where local policy is the most powerful tool, right? I'm not going to deny that necessarily. But cooperative models can be really instrumental in creating better options. For instance, one legacy in New York City, for example, is that unions had a long history going back to the early industrial period of actually developing some of those big co-op buildings in New York City. You know, I have friends who live in, you know, old co-ops formed by labor unions. And the only reason my friends are living there is because 100 years ago, some union started a building, including those big towers like Co-op City. If you're driving north of New York up into upstate areas, you know, you pass these huge towers. They come by that name, honestly. It was a recognition on the part of the labor union of exactly what you described. Finally, you know, brought up issues of the platform economy. I think one example of municipal intervention that is so important and so little discussed is what Austin, Texas did when they required Uber and Lyft to fingerprint their drivers just like taxi drivers had to do. Basically said, hey, you're doing basically the same thing. You're driving strangers. You should have the same level of, you know, those strangers should have the same level of protection that, you know, that people riding in taxis do. This drove Uber and Lyft out of the city. They said, we're not going to play by those rules because if you do it, everybody else is going to do it. And it's going to put more friction in our business. We're going to start becoming more like those highly regulated taxis. The result was Austin was able to spin up a nonprofit rideshare company, which I've used. It works just as well as Uber and Lyft, except it, rather than paying 20% or more, drivers are paying $1 per ride. And riders are able to donate to local nonprofits, and the organization is able to develop its policies in relationship with the city because they're both of comparable scale. They also formed a taxi cooperative. And then the Republican-dominated state government reversed that policy, and Uber and Lyft came back and, you know, we were able to reclaim a lot of the market share. But this is an example of what it looks like. When all a city does is, you know, demand parity, demand that essentially the platform companies, you know, obey laws that preceded them, and cities take an active role in shaping alternatives. You know, these companies have given us the impression that only the biggest multi-billion dollar companies in the world can do these simple app-based technologies. That's not the case, and that example shows that a different kind of structure is possible for our technologies. We just haven't given ourselves the chance to adopt it. It's been a really important feature of the history of cooperative enterprise around the world that public policy has to be intentional toward it. And this is not because these are, you know, charity cases. The reason is simply that otherwise public policy is super, super favorable to, you know, profit-seeking, wealth-oriented business, right? I mean, think of the ways in which, you know, the capital gains tax rate influences how capital is able to direct the economy, right? The fact that you pay so much less for gains on the stock market than you do for income in many cases is, you know, just such an indication of priorities. When you see the amount of money that jurisdictions pay, you know, the Amazon headquarters case farce is the latest example, right? But this is happening all the time, all over the country, where local jurisdictions, especially impoverished ones, are paying through the nose for distant companies to come in, employ some of their workers, and extract value out of town. And what we've seen is actually, if you invest those resources in supporting locally grounded cooperative businesses, your return on investment is much higher. And that's part of the data that is backing a lot of the policy experimentation going on now. And so locally, I think the case is really strong. And we see examples where people are developing different models for how local procurement, you know, provisions might be made so that there's incentives for governments to procure goods and services through cooperatives, or local anchor institutions like hospitals and universities. And so that's a major opportunity. The other is around financing. Another feature of our subsidy for, you know, the capitalist class is, you know, is in the core of the monetary system. You know, that large banks have access to cheaper money than anyone else on earth, right? Through their relationship with the Federal Reserve and their ability to lend. What happened with the rural electric cooperatives was essentially bank rate loan program was established, enabling cooperatives to borrow at the same rate that banks were doing from the government, right? So it's really, once again, leveling the playing field, but it requires intentional policy. And what I would love to see in the next generation of cooperative policy is a wholesale a program of that sort that enables comparably cheap financing to become accessible for democratic business so that people at least have the choice, an even choice, when they're building a business, whether they're going to do it with democracy or whether they're still on team monarchy. So I think the opportunities are tremendous in that respect. It's an ambitious idea, but it's something that has been done in much more specified segments of the economy over and over in the past. And I think it's time that we get a lot more ambitious with how we support and encourage this kind of business.
You were just listening to Nathan Schneider on Co-op's Economic Democracy. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado. Nathan Schneider is a journalist and professor of media studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's the author of Everything for Everybody, the radical tradition that is shaping the next economy. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Robin Kelly, Barbara Ehrenreich, Kali Akuno, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Arjun Singh Sethi, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Tim Butler recorded the program. Special thanks to Veterans for Peace, Boulder Chapter. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.